every single newspaper website will be influencing people's opinions. All of social media, I mean, even leaving aside traditional media, all of social media will be influencing people's opinions.
Well, this is a debate that could go on for the next 4 hours and none of us have time for it.
Really? Kate, do you have a view on it?
About whether we should or shouldn't talk about it. I'm kind of fine with not.
No, fine.
See?
Fine.
We don't want to talk about it anymore.
You two are just too reasonable for my taste.
We will be talking about it tomorrow morning, though. Thank you for riding with me on Early Breakfast this morning. I leave you in the very capable hands of Stig and Kate. I'll see you tomorrow.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock. This is Stig Abel and Kate McCann with Times Radio Breakfast.
Headlines this morning, the Times has found that Jeffrey Epstein was trafficking women through British airports and RAF bases for more than a decade after his first conviction for a child sex offence, and a review of NHS maternity services has found families may have been wrongly told their babies were stillborn.
Ahead, the polls open in Gorton and Denton in an hour. We'll set out what's at stake and we'll look at President Trump's options on Iran with somebody who ran the White House Situation Room.
It's Thursday, the 26th of February.
This is Times Radio.
First, let's get the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Kate. Good morning. Jeffrey Epstein was trafficking women through British airports as late as June 2019, just weeks before being arrested. The Times has analysed booking records, fuel receipts and flight logs disclosed in the Epstein files. They show the paedophile financier flew in and out of Britain by private jet more than 60 times. Six police forces are investigating whether victims were trafficked into RAF bases as well as regular airports. Documents show Epstein's jet landed at RAF Northolt in West London as recently as 2015. The former Prime Minister Gordon Brown has given detectives a dossier of evidence. Lib Dem MP Christine Jardine says the United States must go further in uncovering the truth.
What's going on in America? Why are we hearing nothing in America? We are doing, I believe, the right things in investigating this, trying to get to the bottom of it, seek some transparency. But this was, you know, something which was going on in America primarily. We need to know, we need the Americans to be doing this as well.
A review of NHS maternity services has found that parents whose babies did have signs of life may have wrongly been told they were stillborn. That was done in order to prevent an inquest. The report warns the NHS is incentivised to record deaths as stillborn because coroners cannot investigate such cases. It says parents are being tormented by ambiguity. The investigation led by Labour peer Baroness Amos has also found issues with staff shortages, culture and leadership, as well as racism and discrimination. Some mothers shared their experiences last year.
I was sick up to 30 to 36 times a day. I couldn't function, but I was never believed. I was told everybody gets sick in pregnancy. Even when I was laying on a toilet floor in A&E for 6 hours, unable to get up, they still didn't believe me.
Ministers could announce plans within days to ease student loan repayments. Changes are expected alongside Rachel Reeves's spring statement. Options include raising the repayment threshold and cutting interest rates. Four people have been killed after a US-registered speedboat entered Cuban waters, with authorities in Havana saying those on board opened fire on border guards. Six others were injured in the confrontation near the island's northern coast. An investigation is underway to establish what happened. US officials say the identities of those involved remain unclear at the present time. Polls open at 7 a.m. in the Gorton and Denton by-election. The constituency's former MP Andrew Gwynn stood down for health reasons. People have until 10 p.m. to cast their vote. And we could be in for an explosion of spring colour over the next couple of weeks. The Royal Horticultural Society says warmer conditions will quickly bring flowers into bloom. It's predicting that daytime temperatures in double figures and overnight ones above 5 degrees will lead to colourful displays. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online and on your smart speaker. Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide.
Good morning. This is Stig Abel and Kate McCann with Times Radio Breakfast. It's 4 minutes past six. In an hour's time, the polls will open in the Gorton and Denton by-election, where voters will decide a three-way split between Labour, the Greens and Reform UK. All three parties need to win, but obviously only one of them can. We won't be able to talk about it after this hour, so in the next few moments we'll bring you an update on the latest polling and we'll work out who's likely to come out on top. We'll also get into the Chagos row today. Yesterday, the government said it was pausing the deal after Donald Trump withdrew his support. Today, we're told there is no pause, but there's also no timetable for signing any agreement either. So where does that leave us? We've got a clutch of experts to take us through what's really going on this morning.
When is a pause not a pause?
It's a very good question that nobody knows the answer to.
The problem is a Foreign Office minister said there is a pause, and then a Foreign Office spokesman said there isn't a pause.
Well, unfortunately, the Foreign Office minister said it in the House of Commons and then was completely, well, the rug pulled from under them by their own bosses in the department.
It's just that, I mean, is this the one of the longest forming U-turns ever? You just wonder,
like turning a tanker around.
Yeah, at some point you've got to imagine they're just going to U-turn it. But we're going to talk about that. Maybe they won't. We'll find out, I suppose, over the next few days. We're also focused on defence this morning as the minister warns the UK is not ready to fight the battle that's just around the corner. Al Khan's a man also tipped to take over if Keir Starmer is ousted. But I feel he's a massive...
He's an outsider, definitely. But he's the reason people talk him up is because he's a straight shooter. Literally.
But that was supposed to be Keir Starmer, wasn't it?
Well, no, I think Keir Starmer was supposed to be the safe pair of hands after the Truss years. So yes. He was supposed to be the grown-up in the room who wouldn't be motivated by pure politics, which now we've decided we don't like.
But we want some, yeah.
Now we wanted Trump.
But Cameron was an outsider, wasn't he, at various points?
Well, Cameron was young and an unknown, really. Yeah. Although he'd been in politics, worked in politics for a long time.
I mean, outsiders can get it, though, can't they? I mean, it's not impossible. Obama was an outsider at a certain point in American politics. No one believed he was going to stand for election.
Well, a lot of the coverage, if you look at the coverage of Tony Blair, he was very, very critical. People were saying, too young, won't get it, not very good, doesn't have the background.
Are you saying, can someone clip this? Al Khan's is the next
Al
Tony
Khan's
Blair.
Al Khan's the leader.
Are you saying that?
Not quite yet.
No. Anyway, he's been talking to a podcast and says that we're training our troops in the wrong types of warfare and that he could teach his own son to be more effective with a drone in 2 weeks. It begs a number of questions. Are we actually learning the lessons from the Ukraine conflict quickly enough or at all? And are we focused enough on the issue of defence, as another warning is issued today that we couldn't send the 5,000 forces we've promised to Ukraine without having to withdraw from other areas first, making us vulnerable on those fronts? And you'll be bored of hearing it from us because we mention it all the time. There is this thing called the Defence Investment Plan, where the government said last summer, we've got this, we're going to set out precisely how we're going to spend the money, what the future of war is, where it's all being done. We talk about it all the time. It's still not here.
We've accidentally made it our mission on this programme, haven't we, to have it published?
And I'm not sure enough people care about it, but we'll talk to Patrick Sanders, the former senior general. I bet he cares about it.
He will care deeply about it, not least because his job really was to manage the people and the actual sort of are we ready to do this aspect. Yeah. So we'll speak to him later on this morning around 7 o'clock. Elsewhere, we'll bring you the best letters to the Times this week, always our favourite part of a show on a Thursday. We'll talk about young people out of work with the man tasked to fix the problem by the Prime Minister. And we'll hear the latest on the maternity scandal in this country. There's a new report out today. It's really incredibly shocking. It's the front page of the Times too. It suggests that the NHS is incentivised to wrongly record babies' deaths as stillbirths.
We'll try and find some bright spots as well this Thursday morning too, although I think Kate's just trying to start one of those local regional wars where we debate whether it's called a cob or a bread cake. It will be. People just say Yorkshire puddings are better than Lancashire hot pot or Eccles cakes.
Well, we're talking about regional dishes.
I'm not sure there's a Midlands regional dish, you know.
Isn't it? Oh, no, I don't know.
No, I just don't think there is.
Is it pizza? Well, I feel like it'd be quite bland, so sorry.
I can't. See, you...
I've started.
We're 15 seconds in and we're always having this.
Do you want to know what the sun's... One of my favourite things to do in the morning is to go through the sun and look for the nibs. And it's a sun nib this morning. The headline, Bayek, it's tasty.
Well done.
Eccles cake, haggis, Lancashire hot pot and chicken parmo are our most popular regional dishes.
Where's chicken parmo?
I think chicken parmo is that. It's chicken, Australian. But with cheese. Is it chicken and cheese?
It's like a bastardised Italian thing, but it's very big in Australia. I don't know about that.
Well, we will find out this
morning.
If you
want to nominate your regional dish, particularly if you live in the Midlands, help me out here. What is it? It can't just be a cob. Maybe it is. And also, I'm not saying I'm boring and predictable, but Peter tuned in specifically for what he called my quixotic windmill tilting this morning, knowing that I would object to the broadcasting rules stopping us talking about Gorton and Denton. So, Peter, I'm pleased I didn't disappoint you. I've disappointed myself a little bit. 0333 023 2353. If you want to get in touch this morning, you can text us on 87222, starting with the word Times, or email our producer, Emma, on studio@times.radio. Emma's from Norwich. Is there a Norwich regional dish you want to try and think about? Coleman's mustard. Is mustard a dish?
That's not a dish, though. You wouldn't eat Coleman's mustard out of the jar, would you?
It'd be tough if you had to. You can let us know anyway. 6:09. Polls open in the Gorton and Denton by-election, as we've been discussing in just under an hour. Three-way race, Labour, Greens and Reform. Labour won the Manchester seat by 13,000 votes in 2024, but has since seen its popularity in the area plummet. The Green Party has been leafleting in Urdu and Bengali, urging voters to punish Labour over its stunts on Gaza, while Reform UK is polling strongly in the predominantly white wards of Denton, accusing the Greens of sectarianism. Joe Twyman is the director of the public opinion consultancy Delta Poll, joins us now. Joe, morning to you.
Good morning.
Notoriously difficult to poll by-elections. Do you have any sense of where we currently are?
Well, yes, there has been a small amount of polling, but it all has a very large margin of error associated with it. And so from the polling, we can conclude that the winner will be the Greens or Reform or Labour, which is essentially the situation that we're in at the beginning when the by-election was called. It could be any of them. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be close, because we could see situations, particularly with turnout on the day, that delivers a strong victory to one party or the other. But I think a three-way split to some degree is probably what we are going to see. But who comes out top of that is very complicated. It's perfectly possible, for instance, that the progressive, for want of a better expression, vote is split between Labour and the Greens. That lets Reform in on a relatively low share of the vote. Alternatively, it could be that the anti-establishment vote is split between Greens and Reform, and perhaps that may mean that even Labour is able to stay in. It's also the case that Greens could come through in the areas that you've mentioned, but we don't know.
Well, what everyone always says, and again, I'm sure this is true, that, you know, by-elections don't mean anything. They're not really indicative of the national picture. But it strikes me, just even hearing your conversation there, the reason this one is so interesting is, a three-way split is interesting in and of itself. But it feels it will point to various political forces that are clearly going to be important in national politics in the run-up to the next election.
You're right that by-elections are weird and wonderful in their own ways, and they all have unique circumstances that make it very difficult to extrapolate a national story from the result. And indeed, you could argue that too much attention is paid to the winner as opposed to the movements of the parties. But where they're crucially important is in terms of the story that they tell about our politics. Who's up? Who's down? Where is the wind blowing? And this wind of anti-establishment, anti-mainstream parties that we have seen in the polling now for a long time could be galvanised at this by-election. It could be the case, for instance, that Labour are pushed into third, a distant third, if that anti-establishment feeling is really as strong as some of the polls nationally suggest that it might be. Reform have led in every published national poll since May of last year. Since September's election of Zach Polanski, the Greens have really done very well themselves and improved their position significantly. Will that play out in this by-election? Quite possibly.
Do we need to start considering and talking more openly and fairly and frankly about the issue of sectarianism in British politics, where you're going to have a predominantly white area where Reform are going to poll well, potentially, and the Greens very specifically targeting the Muslim population, you know, doing leaflets and broadcasting Urdu and Bengali. The idea that Gaza, which we've seen in other seats, particularly in urban areas around the country, the idea of Gaza-Israel becoming a key electoral issue. Is the notion of sectarianism in British politics one that we need to talk a bit more about, do you think?
Well, I certainly think it's something to be considered. Of course, as you mentioned, at the last general election, it was an important issue in some very specific areas. And one of the interesting and some may say unique aspects of this by-election that does set it apart from the national picture is the fact that you do have a particular ethnic group within the constituency. But the constituency itself is also very demographically divided. Mm. You have one side that is very white working class. You have another which has a large ethnic minority population, but also a large young professional population, some students, some academics, that sort of thing. And so it really is one and another. But with regards to sectarianism more widely, I think the important question will be, with the rise of Reform and with the rise of Greens and other anti-establishment movements, we could be entering a situation where you have five or six parties vying for individual constituencies. And in a first-past-the-post system, that means that it's perfectly possible that someone could win on 20-25% of the vote at the next election. And so if you can galvanise a specific group within your constituency, and that can be an ethnic group, that could be any other kind of demographic group, that could be hugely helpful when every single vote could make a difference.
That's so interesting. But before you go, we talked a little bit this week that Labour have been saying, oh, we've got a chance, that's why Keir Starmer went there. The betting markets, Joe, have been relatively solid, it strikes me. You know, the Greens are favourites, Reform are second favourites, and Labour have been between 5 and 6 to 1. Kezia Dugdale was on our programme saying, just ignore betting markets, they don't matter. You look at numbers more closely. Do they show anything? Should we take anything from what the betting markets say?
Well, what the betting markets usually reflect is the strength of betting that people have put on. And sometimes that betting is informed on a large amount of information. At a general election, for instance, you can take multiple polls every day and assess where you think things are going to be. But in this instance, unless you're on the ground, you have actually no sense of what's going on other than the polls, which, as I say, have been very few and have a very large margin of error associated with them. And even if you are on the ground, it's very difficult to get a representative sense of what things are going on. And so that's why, not just in this by-election, but in many by-elections where there is very little or no information, the betting markets have a tendency to be either inaccurate or, on some occasions, just completely wrong. And incidentally, before you do ask, yes, Balti is the national dish of the Midlands, specifically the West Midlands. It was invented in Birmingham.
Okay, so that's the... Well, I'm an East Midlander, though, Joe, so I wonder, should we draw a line between the two? Because a lot of people have been suggesting the Melton Mowbray pork pie, which would be an East Midland dish.
So there's your division.
There we go. Pork pie and Balti. Joe, you've been informative in more ways than one. Thank you so much. That's Joe Tomlin. I don't want it from Delta Pol. I don't want to encourage people to gamble, but if what Joe's said is right, which I'm sure it is, you might as well bet on Labour. If it's all to play for and you've got odds of either, you know, the Greens are sort of 6-2 on and Labour is 6-1, then if it's completely up in the air, then you might as well put your money on where you're going to get your best return. So the value in the bet is on Labour.
Yeah, I make a rule never to bet on politics. In fact, I don't really bet on anything.
I'm interested in betting because it's such a phenomenon. If you watch any form of sport, it's the thing that completely owns sport now and in many ways has ruined the coverage of sport. But the value in the market seems to be on Labour at the moment.
Good morning to Cliff, who says, I just tuned in. I didn't think you could talk about by-elections on polling day. You're right, Cliff, we can't, but only after the polls open, and that's at 7. So you've got another 45 minutes to cram it all in. And in order to do that, we are going to read out the candidates list for Gorton and Denton, because we have to do that legally. Would you like to start?
I do, because I would like to start, this, yes. Sir Oinkelot, the official monster raving loony party.
Nick Buckley, Advance UK.
Charlotte Cadden, Conservative and Unionist Party.
Dan Clark, Libertarian Party.
Matt Goodwin, Reform UK.
Sebastian Moore, Social Democratic Party.
Joseph O'Meara, Rejoin EU.
Jackie Percy, Liberal Democrats.
Hannah Spencer, Green Party.
Angeliki Stogia, Labour Party.
Hugo Wills, Communist League Election Party.
And you can find that full list on whocanivotefor.co.uk.
And actually, we were just talking that if we're going to do more of these by-elections, we're going to try and get a celebrity to do that. a pre-recorded celebrity.
That would be fun.
Yeah, we could just find someone. I think it would have to be a very low... To meet the tone of the programme, it would have to be a low-rent celebrity.
Well, you know those celebrities now that you can pay Cameo. £20 on Cameo. So yeah. We could just pay a celebrity to...
Yeah.
I'll pay £20.
I think
fine.
Nigel Farage is on Cameo.
We can't get... That would be problematic,
I think. Be wrong. Okay, before we move off this and get into the important issue, which you started knowingly, and I saw the gleam in your eyes as we were doing this. Who has got the most at stake? Because we're just talking about it's up for grabs. We have Labour, Reform, Greens. We've all throughout this week we talked about how the different levels of it. Who do you think ultimately is most nervous this morning?
Strangely enough, I think Reform UK. And the reason I think that is because this by-election was seen very early on as theirs to take. It was definitely Reform UK's. They picked a high-profile candidate. Yeah. They talked up their chances. They spent a lot of time talking about how this was the sort of Reform UK revolution and they were going to sweep the board. This for Reform UK is a real test of how strong their support is and how much people feel that they can trust the party as a party of government. And if you think about everything Nigel Farage has done over the last couple of months, it's to try and make Reform UK a legitimate palatable, political yeah. force. Palatable is an interesting word for it, and we could debate that. But it's also about, you know, talent, experience, understanding government, working out what it takes to actually really govern and design policies. He's scrapped some of his economic policies, yeah. for example. That's a huge thing for a party to do. He's professionalising, and this is a key moment. I think for Labour, the Prime Minister's loss here has already been priced in and hung around his neck. He's already in a problematic position himself. So I think although, you know, Labour would like to win it if they lost it,
third would be bad, though, wouldn't it?
I think third would be very bad. Don't get me wrong. I think it'd be bad for all of them. I think it would be bad for Keir Starmer, but the price of that has already really been sort of... it's already been priced in, is what I'm trying to say. So I think for Reform UK, it would be bad. For the Greens, I think, you know...
The Greens are kind of... Also, it strikes me that if there wasn't a big Muslim community in this constituency, I'm not sure we're talking about the Greens at all.
Well, I think a lot of people have seen the Greens' strategy here as quite cynical, and I wonder yeah. whether that will do some damage to them in seats around the South, where maybe they were thinking they could pick up from the Lib Dems and the Labour vote. Yeah. I wonder whether they can do that now, given what they're trying to do is face different directions for different constituencies.
And they're still parvenus, really, aren't they? No one, you know, although they've only just really started polling since Polanski in the sort of 15, 16, 17s. It's not like Reform have had a long chunk of being credible alternatives, and at some point they've got to... That's got to pay off, hasn't it? You can talk about this with us until 7 o'clock, when mad rules stop you from doing it. The internet shuts down and no one's allowed to talk about anything to do with Gorton and Denton until 10 o'clock tonight. 0333 00032353.
We will, though, talk about regional dishes, but we might do that in a moment.
We can do that all day.
We can do that all day long, to our heart's content. It is 6:21. Let's take a quick look at what else is happening online and in the papers this morning.
On the front page of the Times, records show that Jeffrey Epstein was trafficking women through British airports as late as 2019, which was the year he died. He used RAF bases too as late as 2015. Analysis by the Times of booking records, fuel receipts and flight logs disclosed in the Epstein files shows the paedophile financier flew in and out of Britain by private jet more than 60 times.
And Bill Gates has apologised to staff for his ties to Jeffrey Epstein, admitting he had two affairs with Russian women, but he insisted they were not Epstein's victims.
Yeah, Bill Gates' reputation has not lasted well with these Epstein file revelations. The Cuban government says its forces have shot and killed four Cuban nationals on a US-registered speedboat that entered its waters and opened fire on a patrol boat. American Secretary of State Marco Rubio said no US government personnel were involved, which is interesting. That's where everyone's minds first leapt to. Mm. You know, are America looking for an excuse to do something to Cuba? Is the subtext and context of all of this? Rubio said there'd be an immediate investigation.
I'll need to get more fidelity and understanding from them once I get on the airplane about what exactly they're looking for. I don't know who has possession of the vessel, which is the first thing we'd want to have. We obviously want to have access to these people if they are American citizens or U.S. residents. But I'm not going to speculate now, because right now, still, a lot of the information that's out there is information that's been provided by the Cubans. We are going to verify that information independently and reach our own conclusions.
This could be nothing, or it could be the beginnings of something. That's why it's worth just being on your radar. In a statement posted online, Cuba's Interior Ministry said that the speedboat's passengers were armed and intended to carry out an infiltration for terrorist purposes.
And in The Sun, churches are increasingly using computerised bell chimes in favour of traditional bell ringing. The 17th century bells of St. Sampson's Church in Cornwall were recently deemed to be too delicate to be struck by hand, so they've been locked in position and fitted with electromagnetic hammers. churches. The treasurer of the Central Council of Church Bellringers said, "We understand what happened at St. Sampson's, which was the best outcome for various reasons, but we wouldn't want to see that happening more widely."
There we go. Modern life is rubbish. Greg Wallace is on Cameo, says Mark.
Yes, that's what I think that.
That's probably a thumb down from us. The Veterans Minister says we could be in a major military confrontation. We'll be talking a lot about the military as we go through the morning. It's a risky old world out there. We've just heard about Cuba. What is going on in Iran? We're going to hear from an American expert very shortly. This is Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel in association with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
The State of It, USA, is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times that brings you real truth about US politics and power. Join political heavyweights Katie Balls and Gerard Baker as they take a deep dive into the latest wrangles in the White House and bring you intelligent analysis and insight. No fake news, no flag waving, and no Trump derangement syndrome.
Fascinating week in Trumpland, MAGA-land, what used to be called the United States of America.
Just the inside track on the decisions that are shaping America. The State of It USA is available now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
With over 50 years' experience at Fidelity, we believe there's a difference.
Say yes to bagging a great value deal in the TUI sale with a MyTUI account. Say yes to flexible payment options. Say yes to free kids' places. Fly from London Gatwick to over 50 destinations, including Turkey, Mexico, and Cyprus. With so many holiday options to choose from, you pick it, we sort it. TUI, Atoll and app to protect it. Booking T's and C's apply, selected departures, minimum spend apply, subject to availability. See website for details.
You want to keep personal stuff personal? Grab the unrivaled Samsung Galaxy S26 Ultra with an incredible privacy display on EE, the UK's best network. You can trade in your old device and save. Plus, you can get 512 gigabytes for the price of 256. Pre-order the Samsung Galaxy S26 Ultra on EE. Offer ends 10th of March.
Eligibility, credit check and terms apply. Credit by EE Limited. Verify best network at ee.co.uk/claims.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Find out how they're protecting members from fraud however you choose to bank by searching nationwide/stopfraud.
Good morning. This is Times Radio Breakfast. One of the last chances to avert an American attack on Iran happens later today. Officials from both countries are meeting in Geneva for talks. As we've been telling you this week, the US has now sent its largest military deployment since the Gulf War in 2003 to the region. Let's get an insight from someone who knows firsthand what goes on behind closed doors when a US president decides to make a major military intervention. Mark Gustafson was head of the White House Global Situation Room under Joe Biden. He told me that conflict now seems inevitable.
I think there's going to be strikes coming soon. And I think it's likely that Trump will engage in comprehensive strikes against the Iranian regime. Likely he'll go after the missile facilities and the nuclear rebuilding that's been happening. And I think that the Trump administration is likely seriously considering decapitation strikes or taking out the Supreme Leader.
The reality is Iran has had some time now to prepare for those strikes. Do you think these strikes by America would be a success in that context?
It comes with a lot of risk. It's going to be riskier than what they did in Venezuela. That said, the Iranian regime is weak right now. It's experienced a number of setbacks, especially last year, where it lost a lot of its long-range ballistic missile systems. More than a dozen of the most senior and most capable IRGC leaders were killed last year. Its nuclear scientists were killed last year. The Iranian proxy groups across the region have been set back, and their capabilities have diminished significantly in the past 2 years.
But are we clear about what military capabilities Iran still possesses and where those assets actually are?
I think there's still some question marks there, but some of that is clear to the US and to the Israelis and the intelligence communities in both places. I think that the long-range ballistic missile systems are the ones that are most worrisome to the Israelis. They were able to go after a lot of those last year. I think the estimates now are probably about 1,700 to 2,000 missiles that they have. Israel is well placed to defend itself against those. I think that they were effective in it last year in going after some of the missiles before they were launched. And then, of course, when they were in the air, Now the U.S. has a much larger presence in the Persian Gulf than it did before and has the capabilities to go after some of those missiles before they're launched in ways that they didn't last year. So I think that that helps Israel. I think on the short-range ballistic missiles and what the Iranians could use to go after the U.S. bases in the region and to go after ships that are passing through the Persian Gulf, that's where it gets a little more dangerous because the Iranians have thousands of those short-range missiles, and they could use them in the Persian Gulf to take shots at these ships that are passing by. They could go after the military bases that are there, and there are tens of thousands of Americans at those bases. That presents a lot of risks, but at the same time, the U.S. military presence in the Persian Gulf, with all the destroyers they brought in, with the aircraft carrier that's there and the other aircraft carrier that's off the coast of Israel, and all of the air power that they have, which is, by my estimate, probably double than what they had last year. They have a lot of capabilities to defend the assets there. And I think it'll be hard for the Iranians to hit them. It's dangerous and it's a risky gambit, but I think is a lot less risky than it was last year or the year before.
And is the justification, because Donald Trump in his State of the Union address suggested that Iran was working on missiles that would soon be able to reach the US itself. Is that the justification for this action?
I think there's a few justifications. I think there's a fear that Iran will use long-range missiles to go after Israel again, and the US will get pulled into that and be responsible for helping Israel defend itself, which the US has done before. I think there's also the worry about the nuclear facilities and Iran rebuilding the nuclear program so that that could pose a threat again. Mm. Iran also is looking at more advanced weapon systems, like missiles that can travel faster and can more easily penetrate defense systems that the Israelis have and that the US have.
And your current day job is all about managing risk. I mean, what in your view is the risk of a military intervention by America, the type that we're talking about, on regional stability?
I think the risks are a lot less than they used to be. On regional stability, the biggest worry a couple years ago was that all of the proxy groups that were aligned with Iran would start attacking U.S. bases in the region, would attack Israel, would go after U.S. embassies. And the risks are still there, but they're significantly less than what they were before. And as I mentioned before, all of those groups have not been replenished for the last year or two because Iran has been unable to replenish them at the same rate that they were before. So they're not getting as much, but they also lost a lot of their capabilities before, and it's zapped their ability to hit the same targets that they used to.
That was Mark Gustafson there, the former head of the White House Global Situation Room.
So that's international news. What about the crucial intranational debate, which is about regional dishes, which you've started? Colin says English, East Midlands, because I'm an East Midlander and we couldn't work out where there was a regional dish. East Midland dishes and food include Bakewell pudding, Melton Mowbray pork pie, Stilton cheese, Lincolnshire sausages.
Ooh. Yeah.
They're all good. They're all good shouts.
Bakewell pudding's a really good shout. I really enjoyed this one. You haven't left your name, so we can't give you any credit for it. But somebody messaged in to say, well, who knew? I've learned something new today. And it's only gone six. Chicken parmo, which is what we were talking about as a regional dish, I think in the northeast.
Middlesbrough, I believe, yeah.
Chicken parmo was created by a Greek-American army chef who settled in Teesside after being wounded in World War II. Breaded chicken escalope served with cheddar cheesy sauce.
Oof.
Someone else described it as a cheesy surprise.
We were trying to work out whether Emma's native Norwich has any native dishes. Norfolk dumplings, says David, which sounds like an East Anglian term of affection.
I think we should move on, shouldn't we? It is just gone 6:30. We'll speak to the government after 7:30 this morning. And we will hear from the Homelessness Minister. Coming up, we'll get you your daily briefing on politics, business and sport after the headlines with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Kate. Good morning. Jeffrey Epstein was trafficking women through British airports as late as June 2019, just weeks before being arrested. The Times has analysed booking records, fuel receipts and flight logs disclosed in the Epstein files. They show the paedophile financier flew in and out of Britain by private jet more than 60 times. Documents show his jet landed at RAF Northolt in West London as recently as 2015. A review of NHS maternity services has found that parents whose babies did have signs of life may have wrongly been told they were stillborn. That was done in order to prevent an inquest. The report warns the NHS is incentivised to record deaths as stillborn because coroners cannot investigate such cases. It says parents are being tormented by ambiguity. Labour peer Baroness Amos's final recommendations are due to be published in April. But Sarah Hawkins, whose daughter was stillborn, is not hopeful.
Everything that's in the report we know already. There is nothing new. It feels like a report of a report. One of our biggest frustrations is that there isn't a deep dive into the regulators, and that's where our focus needs to be.
And the centrepiece of a £3 million revamp of the Diana, Princess of Wales Memorial Playground, a 17-metre galleon, has been lifted into place in Kensington Gardens. The wooden ship was brought across the North Sea from Rotterdam in Holland to Tilbury in Essex. The attraction, which gets 1 million visitors a year, reopens in the summer. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
With over 50 years' experience, Fidelity can help you feel confidently invested.
Dear Tesco Mobile Club Card customer, we have some important news to share regarding your contract. It's not changing. Because with Club Card prices, your price stays frozen. So, unlike with some other networks, you'll have one less surprise bill to worry about. Yours helpfully, Tesco Mobile.
It pays to be connected. P.S. Terms at tescomobile.com/frozen.
Hello, Greg James here.
And I'm Seema Pankhania.
And we're the hosts of The Tesco Kitchen.
Every week, Greg and I are joined by a real food legend to cook a recipe that really means something to them and show us how it's done.
This week, we're joined by food royalty with the one and only Monica Galletti.
Monica is going to be giving us our very own masterclass in cooking her Samoan pani popo. Soft, fluffy buns that are going to change your breakfast game forever.
Move over, porridge. There's a new sheriff in town.
It's live right now on YouTube, so go check it out.
Kate McCann and Stig Abel on Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Choose to bank in branch, online, on the phone, or through their app.
Good morning. It is 6:35. This is Times Radio Breakfast with Stig Abel and Kate McCann. We've got lots for you on the programme today. The Homelessness Minister, Alison McGovern, joins us at the slightly later time of 7:30 this morning. And we'll also speak to the Shadow Defence Secretary at around 9:15. This will be really interesting, especially because we've got the NEET figures, that not in education, employment or training figures. They're out at 9:30 this morning. We'll get you the best analysis on those when they come out. But before that, we'll hear from the former Health Secretary, Alan Milburn. He's the man who's been given the job of working out how to get young people back into work by the Prime Minister. He's got some pretty strong views on how to do that. He's going to come on the programme before those numbers are out and explain where he's at with his research. And we'll also talk through the news of the day, of course, as we do every morning from 9, with the historian Peter Frankopan and the journalist of the future, Jenny Kleeman.
It is 6:36, time for our daily briefing on the day's politics, business and sport. Politics first with Times Politics newsletter editor Stefan Bosher. Morning, Stefan.
Morning.
We're just about regional dishes. Kate is Yorkshire pudding. I've got Melton Mowbray pork pie. You're representing the great region of Australia. What's the Australian national dish? Is it pie? There's the pie floater. Is that the Australian national
dish? What?
You've not heard
of it? No, pie floater is really regional. So that's just from Adelaide only. And as a Melbourne boy, that's definitely not one of us. So basically, pie floater is like a pie on top of a pea soup, which is like very regional for South Australia. Australia's weird because we don't really have a regional dish because we really are a nation of immigrants.
What's in Melbourne? What's the Melbourne dish?
Well, okay, Melbourne dish is avocado on toast. We invented that in flat white. So brunch I suppose is us.
You're my people.
Yeah, there'll be many. You're the reason why millennials can't afford houses.
Yeah.
Exactly. It all comes from the people of Melbourne. Let's talk about politics, shall we? Because we've only got 23 minutes before we can have to stop talking about Gorton and Denton for at least 12 hours. I was talking with Kate before, Stefan, interested in your thoughts on this. Who's got more at stake? Because it's a three-way fight between Labour, Reform and the Greens. who do you think has got more at stake this morning as they look ahead to this?
I think it is, fundamentally, it is Labour, because if Starmer does lose, and if he comes in third place, for instance, which, you know, if it's as close as the polls suggest, is a possibility, that, you know, potentially could be terminal for his leadership, or at the very least, it could, you know, start a long process or short process of him being unseated as Labour leader. So I think, you know, that existential question for the Labour leadership does put it in a different category from Reform or the Greens. But, you know, as you say, you know, there is risk here for both those parties. If Reform do underperform, if they can't really crack much above the 28% barrier, for instance, which is around where they're polling, there will be real questions around their viability as a genuine party of the right in this country. And likewise, if the Greens, even with a candidate who is local in a by-election which has been very divisive, if they can't unseat Labour as the second party in this race and as the party of the left, when, you know, the government is so unpopular, there will be some real questions about Zach Polanski and their strategy.
I'm really interested in the Green strategy, and I don't know how far to put it. So I interviewed Zach Polanski in this week, and I said, people think you're a sectarian, you're a sectarianist party. But it does strike me that we at least need to start reflecting on we have certain constituencies where there are big ethnic minority populations who have clearly geopolitical views, and the Green Party is directly targeting its views towards them. That will become an issue in a widespread, more widespread election if there's a feel that there is a sort of sectarian element to British politicking.
We're already seeing in the last election the Gaza Independent MPs, of which there are four or five, forgive me, I can't exactly remember, I think four, in Parliament right now. I mean, they ran very sectarian campaigns and campaigns which focus, you know, really solely on issues to Muslim communities, let's say on Gaza. But as we've seen in this campaign, there's also, it goes beyond that. There's a whipping up of the divides between India and Pakistan, for instance, other racial and religious divides in the community as well. And the Greens have been very happy to lean back on this and try to exploit this, much in the way that George Galloway did. And I think the fact that this is becoming a tactic which at least, you know, people like the Greens think will be useful in this seat and probably many other seats across the country is quite a disturbing thing in British politics. And it does show how many people, many communities do feel utterly disengaged from the mainstream culture in this country.
Yeah, and I wonder whether there's anything, I've been thinking about this, is there anything intrinsically wrong with campaigning in Urdu or Bengali? Because at one level, it's just talking to people in a language they'll be familiar with. In another, if we genuinely believe in an integrated society, the idea of voting in a British election, I wonder if you could even say it should always be conducted in British, in English, in the British language, because that's the nature of the electoral process. You know, you're voting for an MP in the national parliament. It's all about being part of the British democratic system.
Sure, absolutely. I don't think the language in and of itself is a problem. I think it's the message that goes along with it. And when messages are put out only for an audience in Urdu, for instance, as we saw with the Greens, and messages only about Modi and Indian Prime Minister and the Pakistani leadership and this, you know, this very, very serious and very historic cultural and historical divide, putting that information just out in that language and then trying to whip up that sort of divide in that language, while then also in English, for instance, doing a very different campaign that's more broadly about economic injustice. Yeah. Green issues. I think that's the problem, and I think that is where it looks not just cynical, but very sinister.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. That before you go, when is a pause not a pause when it comes to the Chagos-sided deal?
It's a very good question. I'm finding this very, very difficult to get my head around, frankly. I mean, Hamish Faulkner, a very talented minister, I must say, he came out yesterday and said that there was a pause in the process because it hasn't been brought back to Parliament. There obviously needs to be talks with the US because President Trump, for now, has withheld his support. But the government's coming out and saying, no, he misspoke. It was not a pause. It's going to come back to Parliament in due process. What that looks like, who knows? I assume it is, as Hamish said, and it will come back when there has been discussions. So it does feel like the government's just got itself in a rhetorical sort of spin cycle here, where we all know that it has essentially been paused and it won't go forward unless Trump somehow relents on it.
Yeah, should we just be definitive there? It's a pause. The minister called it a pause. It's a pause.
We're on a break.
Well done. Stephan Boscher there. Great stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're on a break. And you can read Stefan's newsletter every day at 9 o'clock. If you're a subscriber, go to your Times account and click newsletters.
It is 6:42. We've already read you the full list of candidates standing in the Gorton and Denton by-election. If you miss them, you can go to whocanivotefor.co.uk to see the full list. And of course, you'll hear all the best coverage on Times Radio. You'll hear Tom Noonan presenting a special overnight show with Daryl Morris at The Count, bringing you the results. And Callum MacDonald will have Friday's Times Radio breakfast live from Manchester. And political editor Anna Mihailova will bring all of the reaction from Westminster too.
John says there's going to be two real losers and one survivor by the skin of its teeth coming up. And that could be one analysis that might prove to be true on that programme.
May well be. What are subscribers reading on the Times.com and the Times app this morning?
Third most read.
Here's a young woman joined Epstein's science event attended by Stephen Hawking.
A Nobel Prize winning physicist has described how a group of young women suddenly appeared without explanation at a scientific symposium funded by Jeffrey Epstein and attended by Stephen Hawking. Philip Peebles, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 2019, had no knowledge of Epstein's crimes at the time. However, he said that he now believed the young women he saw at the March 2006 meeting on a Caribbean island were probably victims of the paedophile financier. The Stephen Hawking part of his story is a really, really odd and intriguing one.
In second place,
Jeffrey Epstein, again, trafficked women through British airports as late as 2019, the year he died.
Yes, based on analysis by The Times of booking records, fuel receipts and flight logs disclosed in the Epstein files showing the paedophile financier flew in and out of Britain by private jet more than 60 times. He also used RAF bases.
And the article you're reading most this morning.
Yes, it is Tom Peck's sketch. MPs wince as Badenoch lands some very low blows.
He's had a good week, Tom Peck. He's actually had a very good year. I mean, there has been material for him. I will give him that. He's writing about PMQs yesterday where the Conservative leader used the word pedo defender, perhaps for the first time in Parliament. I think it was the first time in Parliament. Is it a constitutional crisis? Tom asks. It's certainly a non-institutional crisis.
I really don't know where to go from that. It is
the business.
Let's get some business news. It's 6:45. The business world stands and waits these days whenever one particular company has something to say. And that company, of course, is Nvidia, which makes all those computer chips for AI systems. Times Radio's business correspondent Dominic O'Connell is here. Good morning, Dom.
Morning.
So go on then. What are the results?
Well, you're right. Everyone does watch Nvidia very carefully because it is the embodiment of hopes and fears for AI. It's also the world's most valuable company. $4.8 trillion it's worth just itself. £3.5 trillion. What's the whole FTSE 100 worth, Kate?
Oh, hang on, isn't this company worth twice the FTSE 100?
Yeah, close enough. That's very good, actually. The whole FTSE 100 is 2.4 trillion, so maybe not quite twice, but it's worth more than the whole.
Do not mess with the McCann. There you go.
How many Gregs are there?
2,700.
Something like that, yes. So people are wondering, surely Nvidia is going to run out of steam at some stage, but yesterday's quarterly results, no. A 94% increase in profit for the fourth quarter, so that's profits of $43 billion, up from $22 billion the year before. Sales also up 73% to nearly $40 billion. And so Nvidia just keeps on going, and Jensen Huang, its chief executive, was talking about what we kind of already know, really, how computing has now changed forever in the world of workers being upended by AI.
And so will investors be pleased? Because this will have a ripple effect, won't it? For those who have invested in Nvidia and similar companies, it will be a good thing. But for those, and we've seen it in other areas of the stock market, which might be affected by this, this could actually be a bad moment.
Well, the reaction to the Nvidia share price did pretty much nothing yesterday, okay. Because people are kind of very confused about AI at the minute. I don't think you can say anything particularly meaningful about what investors think about AI at the minute, because they're all completely confused, and the stock market reaction has been all over the place.
We should ask AI.
Indeed.
John Lewis elsewhere was going to get into the housing business. Now it's withdrawn from that. What's going on?
Yes, 3 years ago, John Lewis, then run by Sharon White, Baroness White, said it would go into rental housing. The idea was you'd stick rental homes above some of the stores. They even chose some sites, Bromley, Ealing, an old warehouse out in Reading as well. And it set up a joint venture with Aberdeen, the insurance company, to make it all happen. Yesterday they said, no, we're not going to do that anymore. They said it's because of a change in market conditions, a different financial environment. But really, I think it's more about a change of management and a change of approach. John Lewis Partnership's new boss is Jason Tarry. He's ex-Tesco, and he's going right back to focus on the basics of the business, i.e. retail.
Which is probably a good idea.
Well, maybe, yes. Although 3 years ago, a different idea was a good idea. So these things come around and go around.
That is very true. Finally, Dom, we reported yesterday at the end of the programme that there was a question mark over the future of the UK's last helicopter factory. There may be some light at the end of the tunnel.
Yes, this is the old Westland plant in Yeovil, which has been threatened with closure many, many times over the years. Now owned by the Italian defence contractor Leonardo, employs about 3,000 people. It's been waiting for ages for confirmation of a £1 billion contract to provide the Army's new medium helicopter. The other bit is Lockheed and Airbus dropped out last year. Was it going to happen at all? There's worries that it might not happen. Queries about the defence investment plan, Leonardo threatening to close the factory. But yesterday, after he was talking to analysts after some results, the boss of Leonardo dropped a pretty heavy hint that there might well be a deal, Roberto Cingolani. He said, I can't say much about it. I'm bound by a confidentiality agreement. It'll all become clear in a day or two, which is quite different to what he's been saying previously. He's just been roasting the UK government about it. So it looks like maybe Yeovil is going to get out of jail again after all.
Well, we'll keep an eye out for that. Dom, thank you very much. That is our business correspondent, Dominic O'Connell.
Another AI story we'll be doing actually after 7:30 is the chances that AI is likely to lead to nuclear war. If you put AI in charge of gaming, it moves quick. It moves relatively in a conscience-free fashion, as you might imagine, towards pressing the nuclear button.
Which is obvious, really, if you think about it, because AI doesn't need to really worry that much about nuclear fallout, I don't think. And also, if that is your most effective weapon and you're in a war scenario, you're probably going to use it.
But the terrifying thing is that all of the major militaries in the world are integrating AI.
Yeah.
And so if they integrate AI into their decision-making, at what point does that become a problem when it comes to the nuclear button? We'll talk about that after 7:30, just to cheer everybody up. Before all that, we'll get an update on the sport and we'll remember this day in history. This is Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Steve Gable in association with Nationwide. A good way to bank.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow. All the latest national and international breaking news and informative interviews. Plus, hear unrivaled journalistic expertise and detailed analysis on the radio programme where sharp insight meets original thinking. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive. This afternoon from 4 on Times Radio with ServiceNow. The AI control tower for business reinvention. Find out more at servicenow.com.
Daryl Morris wraps up the weekend's news and takes a look at the week ahead, Saturday and Sunday from 10 p.m. It's easy to forget just how crazy things have been over the past couple of years.
Tesco Finest Sourdough. The real breadwinner. Untoasted, really toasted, or buttered right to the edges. Whatever floats your toast, it's delicious either way. It's why only the finest bakers take 24 hours to carefully craft our sourdough. Make your everyday taste better with Tesco Finest. Majority of larger stores.
Say yes to bagging a great value deal in the TUI sale with a My TUI account. Say yes to flexible payment options. Say yes to free kids places. Fly from London Gatwick to over 50 destinations, including Turkey, Mexico, and Cyprus. With so many holiday options to choose from, you pick it, we sort it. TUI, Atoll and app to protect it. Booking T's and C's apply, selected departures, minimum spend apply, subject to availability. See website for details.
And on your smart speaker, Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Able on Times Radio.
It is 6:51. This is Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Able. Now, bear with me on this one. We are going to do the sport, but I'm going to introduce it thus. In medieval times, disputes were sometimes decided by combat. The two opponents would fight it out to show who had right on their side. Which comes to mind when we learn that the footballing gods decided that Real Madrid should beat Benfica last night. Nick Ellerby is with us to tell us about that and everything else. Morning, Nick.
Morning. It reminds me of A Knight's Tale, one of my favourite films. Have you seen that?
Oh, yeah, I love that. With Heath Ledger.
Was that a good film?
Yes.
All right.
And Rufus Sewell as well.
It was a great film.
Yeah, okay.
And Queen. What's not to like? Queen music and jousting.
Yes, yeah. I actually think you could do a very good novel about the jousting going around the tournaments that used to go around Europe. It was like early football. It was the events, these knights would go all around Europe performing in tournaments, and they became like the celebrities of the age, and people came out to look at them. It was like an early version of professional sport.
Is this your next book?
No, someone should write it. Anyway, I don't know how we've ended up in this particular historical cul-de-sac, Nick, but the good thing was that Vinicius Jr. was subject of racist abuse. It wasn't handled
allegedly.
It wasn't handled well, but now Real Madrid won.
No, it wasn't handled well. This is the first leg. Benfica, against Real Madrid. Gianluca Prestiani, Argentine winger, has been accused of racism by Vinicius Jr. UEFA investigation still ongoing. Real Madrid won the first leg 1-0. Benfica took a 1-0 lead last night at the Bernabeu in Madrid. Got a bit nervy, but very quickly, Aurelien Tchouameni, the Real Madrid midfielder, scored an equaliser. And then Vinicius Jr., who scored last week and was booked for his celebration, which led to all that abuse and everything else, then scored the winner last night. Fantastic player. He's actually fourth top Champions League goal scorer for Real Madrid. And he did the same dance that he got booked for by the corner, sort of gyrating by the corner flag. Look, you can take the boy out of Rio.
Wasn't booked.
No, it wasn't booked this time.
No.
And all the Real Madrid fans got behind him with no to racism banners and all that kind of thing.
And the Benfica player said he wasn't being racist, he was being homophobic.
Which could also lead to a 10-game ban, yeah. But he said, whatever he said from behind his shirt. So that
he knew he was saying something dodgy.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't defend himself particularly robustly. The thing is, Argentina and Brazil, have a huge history of war. I mean, football, but is like a war for them.
Yeah.
And actually, football basically is a proxy war anyway. But there's a big...
Like the chivalric tournaments of the 13th century.
Exactly, and that's why we started there. But there's a problem when Brazilian sides play Argentinian sides, that there is this... monkey calling, name calling, racism, racist abuse. There's a huge history of it between those countries. Prestiani is Argentinian and Vinicius Jr. is Brazilian, so I think there's an aspect of that there. But Tchouameni, the French midfielder who scored for Madrid last night, basically said Vinicius' goal is one in the eye for the racists.
Yeah, that's excellent stuff. Man United are having a better season. They might have even found their manager, who knows?
They've stumbled into a good manager.
Yeah, potentially. But this is not a good headline on the back page of the Times today for them.
No, so their debt's now £1.3 billion, which is huge. Most big football clubs are in debt. They run at a loss. So Jim Ratcliffe, the new minority co-owner, the Ineos boss, is trying to sort of sell this in as a positive. So he's saying his cost-cutting measures, when he basically cut about 450 jobs from Manchester United, a lot of local people, which caused a lot of consternation at the time. But he's saying, look, my... unpopular changes are actually leading to an operating profit. So Manchester United actually made a bit of a profit in the last quarter last year. But in terms of total debt, I mean, it's huge. They've got kind of a revolving credit facility they use for transfers. They owe that nearly $300 million. There's a long-standing debt from the takeover, the Glazer takeover, which is $480 million, and also $500 million in trading liabilities, basically unpaid transfer fees. So Man United total debt is £1.3 billion. Tottenham and Everton both have £1 billion worth of debt, but they've built new stadiums, and so they've sort of got something to show for it. Whereas Old Trafford, the Man United Stadium, it's got a leaky roof.
And it's still to be built, a new one's still to be built.
And yeah, they're trying to get public money for that. So what they're trying to do is build this huge new Old Trafford centre, reroute some of the railway lines around there, and sort of have a kind of mini city. So they also give something back to the community as well. But, you know, all of that is still to be approved by planning officials.
Before you go, England Rugby Union team has gone out for a curry.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously England got,
whacked.
I was looking for the right words.
Tonked.
At 6:55 in the morning. But Steve Borthwick's taking the side out for a curry with the 2003 boys. Sort of. So hopefully, you know, a beer and a curry often just sorts these things out, doesn't it?
We had two of the 2003 boys in this studio.
Massive lads.
And Kate was very impressed with Martin Johnson.
He's huge, isn't he?
He just had... big hands.
Yeah.
Case enjoyed his big hands.
His boys.
I actually really enjoyed talking to both of them. I thought they were great.
Jason Robinson, they're lovely. But that's when rugby hit its peak at the early 2000s, and it's gone down.
I was on the streets of London to see them parade the trophy.
Yeah, great moment.
Amazing.
Great moment.
Before you both go,
we've
had a steward's inquiry launched.
Oh, yeah.
So you obviously opened this by talking about The Knight's Tale. There's no dispute. It's a fantastic movie.
Yeah.
Harry Cole, one of our keen listeners, the Sun's editor-at-large, has messaged in, Stig, all in capitals.
Yes.
That, your book idea, is literally the plot of The Knight's Tale.
Yeah, but it's not done very well, is my point. It's done in a silly
fashion. We make a book of the film.
It's done a silly... It's silly.
You said it would make a great novel. Yes, they already made it into a movie.
Yeah, but not a very... Yeah, a silly film. It was a serious one. People like John Marshall going around the... You know, going around being rugged around Europe.
More serious. There you go.
All right, Nick, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Great to have you with us.
I love Nick Ellerby. There we go. Bit of sport, bit of culture, bit of heckling.
Bit of a nice tale.
Heckling from the stands as well. What more do you want in a football report?
It is 6:57. It's time now for our radio version of the Times On This Day feature. On this day, the 26th of February in 1960, the Bank of England issued the first banknote to feature a portrait of Queen Elizabeth II. It marked a significant shift in British currency as it was the first time a reigning monarch's image had ever appeared on a Bank of England banknote since their inception in 1694. The portrait used was an engraving based on a photograph by Robert Austin, though it was initially criticised by some for making the young queen look a tad too stern.
On this day in 1947, the British pop singer Sandy Shaw was born in Dagenham in Essex.
There's a lot of dad dancing going on currently.
I've literally never heard of Sandy Shaw, but that was her 1964 hit. There was always something there to remind me. She was the first Briton to win the Eurovision Song Contest and widely known for performing barefoot on stage, a habit she adopted simply because she felt more comfortable without heels.
You know, that there was a remix of that song.
Was there?
I might dig it out. Yeah. On this day in 1802, the French author and dramatist Victor Hugo was born. Best known as a writer, he was also a politician, a skillful and inventive draftsman, and had a passion for interior design. He was a central figure in the Romantic movement. Hugo wrote Les Mis and The Hunchback of Notre Dame. He was so revered in his own lifetime that on his 80th birthday, he was treated to a national holiday, where he sat at his window and watched as 600,000 admirers paraded past his house.
Les Mis, if you ever read the book is so long. It's such an unbelievably long. It's quite good, but if you're going to take it on, it's going to take some time to get through.
You know what, though, talking of films, The Hunchback of Notre Dame is a great Disney film.
Oh, what's your top Disney film?
That's hard.
Is it Lion King?
No. Lion King's not even in the top 10.
Because you're a different...
Little Mermaid, I think.
Okay. So I remember the one that I liked growing up was... there's two. The Robin Hood one.
Oh, yeah, that was a good one.
And The Fox and the Hound.
Oh, I love The Fox and the Hound.
Yeah, it's too upsetting for my kids. They actually couldn't watch it. It was too real for them.
Did you ever see The Land Before Time?
No.
I couldn't watch that. It was about a dinosaur. I lost his mum.
They really know how to hit hard back in the day.
They really... Bambi.
Oh, yeah, dreadful. Lots more to come on this programme. We might be asking the question just how geared up for war we really are as a society. Some people think not quite enough. Keep your thoughts coming in. 0333 0033 2353.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock. This is Stig Abel and Kate McCann with Times Radio Breakfast.
The headlines this morning, the Times has found that Jeffrey Epstein was trafficking women through British airports and RAF bases for more than a decade after his first conviction for a child sex offence. And a review of NHS maternity services has found families may have been wrongly told their babies were stillborn.
Ahead, why we could be at war in 3 years' time and why AI might make that very bad indeed. Plus, we'll take a look at the brand new Times Good University Guide.
And Andrew's asked who I think will win the Gorton and Denton by-election, and I can no longer say because we will no longer be talking about
that. I literally just took a huge intake of breath because I thought you were about to talk about it.
The polls have now opened in Gorton and Denton. We will now no longer talk about it, but those in that area can now go out and vote.
Don't do that to me.
Don't worry, guys. It's fine. It's Thursday, the 26th of February.
This is Times Radio.
First with the news, here's Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Kate. Good morning. Jeffrey Epstein was trafficking women through British airports as late as June 2019, just weeks before being arrested. More details from Times Radio's Cara Bentley.
The Times has analysed booking records, fuel receipts and flight logs disclosed in the Epstein files. They show the paedophile financier flew in and out of Britain by private jet more than 60 times. Six police forces are investigating whether victims were trafficked into RAF bases as well as regular airports. Documents show Epstein's jet landed at RAF Northolt in West London as recently as 2015. He also booked commercial flights for young women from the UK or who were travelling through it right up until June 2019, only a month before his arrest. The former Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, has given detectives a dossier of evidence. Nazir Afzal, the former Chief Crown Prosecutor, says the findings are scandalous.
A review of NHS maternity services has found families may have been wrongly told their babies were stillborn despite signs of life in order to potentially avoid an inquest. The investigation led by Labour peer Baroness Amos warns the system incentivises the recording of deaths as stillbirths, leaving parents without answers and deepening their trauma. Amos has found issues with staff shortages, culture and leadership, as well as racism and discrimination. In December, she outlined her objectives.
What I have been asked to do is to come up with some clear national recommendations that will stop this and will make a difference. It just cannot continue.
Ministers could announce plans within days to ease student loan repayments. Changes are expected alongside Rachel Reeves's spring statement. Options include raising the repayment threshold and cutting interest rates. The move would mark another government U-turn after it froze the repayment threshold until 2030. Graduate Nathan Wyatt says many young people feel trapped by the current system.
A lot of students are pragmatic. We're not expecting the government to say, we're scrapping tuition fees and everyone gets it for free, you know. We understand that we agreed to these loan terms. And I think what we just kind of wanted was to see that end of the bargain being upheld. Obviously, the 3% on top just seems like an extra punishment.
And Cuba says four people shot dead by border guards off the coast of the island were Cuban nationals living in the United States. Havana says the 10 passengers on board the Florida-registered speedboat opened fire on a Coast Guard vessel which approached them. Cuban authorities say they were armed with assault rifles, handguns and Molotov cocktails. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says an investigation is underway.
I don't know who has possession of the vessel. We obviously want to have access to these people if they are American citizens or U.S. residents. But I'm not going to speculate now because right now, still, a lot of the information that's out there is information that's been provided by the Cubans. We are going to verify that information independently and reach our own conclusions.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide.
Good morning. This is Stig Abel and Kate McCann with Times Radio Breakfast. It's 4 minutes past seven. In the next hour, we'll focus on defence as it emerges the UK is underprepared for conflict coming in the next 3 years. That warning from one of the government's very own defence ministers. We'll find out what he's worried about, and we'll keep an eye on AI too. Why does it reach so quickly for nuclear weapons in simulated conflict? And should it really be built into military systems as a result?
We'll also hear from the government as the Minister Alison McGovern joins us in half an hour. Plus, should it be soft, hard, salted or plain? What am I talking about? Butter, don't worry. You can be a butter sommelier if you knew one of those answers. And if you do, they might want to apply for a new job. The exclusive members club, the Pembroke, is looking for someone to help out. Have we really reached peak capitalism where we need a butter sommelier?
Apparently somebody does.
Work out what it all means. And I'm going to break a little secret here. Kate doesn't like butter at all.
No, that's not right. I don't like butter in most contexts, but there are some contexts where I do.
You don't like butter in sandwiches?
No, I won't eat a sandwich with butter in.
You can WhatsApp us whether you think Kate is normal or not. 0333 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 0003 film.
It's not The Jungle Book.
I do like The Jungle Book.
No, it's not even in the top 10.
8722, starting with the word Times, or email our producer, Emma, on studio@times.radio. We do enjoy your responses, so do keep them coming in.
It is 7:05. One minister seen as a contender to take over from Sir Keir Starmer has told a Times podcast that the UK could be in a major military confrontation in as little as 3 years, and we're not ready for it. The Veterans Minister, Al Carnes, was speaking to General Sir Patrick Sanders, former Chief of the General Staff, and Tom Newton Dunn for the Times General and the Journalist podcast.
The potential for a military confrontation in quite a rapid timescale is increasing. People talk about dates like 2029. I think the Dutch Defence Minister did that, 2030. First of all, do you recognise the urgency of that time frame when it comes to deterring Russia?
Yeah, so 3 to 5 years. I've always been clear on this, and I've been clear with other people. 3 to 5 years for a geographically constrained conflict in some way, shape or form.
So others say it's not 3 years. 2029 is, we'd be lucky. Some say it's 2027 now because of the rate of increase.
And every time we've tried to guess it, we get it wrong. The reality is we need to be ready.
Well, Alkan's also talked about his experience in military training.
The army is training, as the Marines are, for a sniper to shoot one round, one bullet, 800 metres point of aim, point of impact. And I could train my son in 2 weeks to kill you at 45 kilometres in a fibre optic drone.
That was Alkan's. General Sir Patrick Sanders joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Kate.
Were you surprised by that warning from a government minister?
No, I wasn't, because although, you know, we can't predict what the future is going to hold, you can see that the trend is that Europe is much more exposed than it was, and that the sort of inherent internal logic of Russia's war economy means that even if they get a settlement in Ukraine, Putin's ambitions will not stop there. I suppose what I was surprised or encouraged by was the fact that Alkan's, you know, who I know well and have served with, was prepared to be direct and honest.
And do you think we get enough of that honesty? Because we talk a lot on this programme. We speak to lots of people who say, you know, the UK could be ready, we could be prepared, we're putting enough money in. Is that true? Or do we need to get real and stop saying this stuff and start being a bit more truthful about the state of affairs?
I think certainly for those of, you know, people who think about this all the time, nothing that Al has said is a surprise. And you can see from some of the polling and the increased level of debate that the fact that we're not safe and that we're not ready is beginning to cut through. But it's not enough for this to be occasional discussions. We have to make sure that we're explaining to the British people that our priorities have to change. Because if the first rule of government is to protect the country, then you need to see that through. And I don't want to make this political, because I think, you know, every party has been guilty of underinvesting in defence. And I don't really want to talk about numbers, whether it's 2.5% or 3%, because they mask what needs to be done, which is just to get on and make some orders with industry, and make sure that capability gets into the hands of our soldiers, sailors and aviators as quickly as possible so that we can deter what might be coming down the track.
And yet the Defence Industrial Strategy, investment strategy, which was supposed to be published last summer, delayed until autumn, is still not been published.
It's mad. I mean, this is, you know, it's if you're sitting from industry's perspective, you've got companies, whether they're big primes or whether they're small and startups and small and medium-sized enterprises, you know, burning through their own capital, opening factories, you know, doing their own innovation. And there's a limit to how long they can keep that up for. And they can see the urgency. They know what needs to be done. But there's been absolutely no movement at all on orders or a clear demand signal from government for what we need from industry.
Did you get the sense, talking to Alkan's, that he was frustrated with the pace of the government? I mean, we can sort of hive off the political ambitions because I think that is part of this conversation. But he's obviously going further than we would usually expect to see from a government minister. Do you think he's a bit frustrated with the Prime Minister on this?
He was scrupulous in remaining a loyal member of the government and making sure that he wasn't directly criticising. But he's not a normal minister. You know, he's someone who just 2 years ago was a colonel in the Royal Marines. You know, although he wouldn't acknowledge it himself, he's got a very distinguished special forces background, and he came into politics in order to fix things. And it's taking much longer, I think, than he's comfortable with. So yeah, you can feel the frustration coming through, and not just from him, but pretty much anybody who works in and around defence and security is frustrated by the inaction and the lack of a sense of urgency.
One of the things that really struck me is that quote we heard from Alkan's there at the end about, we are training our people at the moment to use technology that basically is obsolete in the war that is going on at the moment in Ukraine, and that he could train his own son to work a drone in just 2 weeks. I mean, when are we going to stop talking about this stuff and see a real change? How long does it take for that change to come through? Because it's clearly not there at the moment.
Well, the changes happen as a result of your experience in war. And each war is different. So, you know, generals like me are always accused of trying to fight the next war like the last one was fought, and it will be different. So, you know, the Ukrainians themselves and indeed the Russians have had to adapt in, you know, initially within a matter of months and now on a pretty much a fortnightly cycle of constant adaptation and iteration of the sort of technologies that we're seeing playing out on the battlefield there. We over-obsess on drones. I think what Al was saying was not you don't need a sniper to, or a soldier or a marine to be able to engage a target at 800 meters. You need to be able to do that, and you need to be able to engage with a drone at 40 kilometers, because both will be relevant in the next conflict. So, you know, the sort of capabilities that are in the existing program, people talk about tanks being obsolete and ships being obsolete. That's not the case. Until a drone is capable of holding ground or taking a city or controlling resources, then you're always going to need humans on the battlefield, and humans are going to need to be protected, and they're going to need to be moved around. So it's additive. It's not replacing it.
I suppose what I'm trying to get at here is when we talk about defence often, we hear people say, you know, the UK is too far behind. We're sluggish. We're not able to see where this technology is going, and we're not adapting to it quickly enough. But we're also not funding the companies that could do that here in the UK. Is that fair? And if you think it is, where does this need to come from? Is it coming from the Prime Minister? Do we need to see more from Keir Starmer to push that forward?
I think it is fair. I mean, it's not wholly fair, because, you know, my former colleagues in the Army, the Navy and the Air Force will absolutely be looking closely at the lessons that are emerging from Ukraine, will be desperate to be able to get these sort of capabilities into the hands of their people, to train with them, and to be able to adapt at the same pace that the Russians and the Ukrainians are showing. But we're not getting, you know, until you make orders, until you give a clear signal, you can give industry confidence that in the way that lots of other countries across Europe have done, I mean, the Poles have done it, the Nordics, the Baltics, the Germans are doing it right now, we're not doing it. And so we are falling behind. Where does that leadership need to come from? Yes, it needs to come from the Prime Minister. You know, he's been good on rhetoric. You know, he talked very, very strongly at the Munich Security Conference about needing to get to 3% by 2029 returning, recognizing that hard power is the currency of the age. But this is a wider debate that has to be had, and it shouldn't be politicized. We need people. We need consensus from both parties that this isn't something that should be politicized, that we need to reprioritize either our public spending, or we need to work closely with private finance to try to raise the money that's needed. But whatever mechanism it is, we need to do it now and urgently.
There is a report today in the paper that the UK cannot send the 5,000 troops to Ukraine that we have promised, because we would have to remove them from other places. Essentially, that 5,000 means 15,000, and committing to that would mean taking them from elsewhere. That's a pretty devastating place for us to be, isn't it?
I'm not going to speculate on where they might come from, because I don't know what, you know, because I'm not close to it anymore. I don't know what the plans are for this force, what the composition is, and therefore where you would force generate it from. The numbers, you know, if it's 5,000 from the UK, then generally speaking, we would want, you know, a pool from 15,000 to draw them from. But this is what this tells us is commitments are getting bigger and harder. And more often, they're coming more often. They're not getting fewer. And yet the size of our armed forces either isn't increasing or in some cases it's reducing.
So
it's just a signal that the age needs us to invest in our own defence and resilience.
So finally, is AI the answer? I mean, we're going to be talking on the programme later on about how AI models tend to opt for nuclear weapons when it comes to these kind of real conflict scenarios. They are now being built into and embedded in lots of areas of military technology, AI systems. Are you comfortable with that? Is that a good idea?
AI is an answer. AI is operating on the battlefield at the moment. I mean, we talk about AI as if it's a single thing. Of course, it's not. You have lots of AIs, lots of different forms of artificial intelligence, and some of them are incredibly helpful. They can support decision making. They can increase the efficiency of logistics. They can take people out of harm's way. But the thing we've always been clear about, and actually we're very good at in this country, is the importance of focusing on AI safety. And we have this amazing AI Safety Institute in the UK that's world leading. And so the idea that you would integrate AI into nuclear firing chains and that sort of decision making, or indeed for the time being on lethal force, that should always be a human decision. It's just a question of how that is done.
Well, we are going to be talking more about that question later. General Sir Patrick Sanders, thank you very much for joining us on the programme this morning.
Okay.
And you can listen to Al Khan speaking on that podcast if you search for The Times' General and The Journalist podcast.
Is there, and it's a competitive field this, is there an area where there's a bigger difference between platitude and rhetoric and actual performance than in military conversations? The number of times we talk about we're at war with Russia, we're effectively at war with Russia, it's coming in 26, 27, 28, we need to get to much more spending, we need to have a society geared to the notion that we have to stop doing something so we can do more in defence spending. It never seems to actually happen. We don't, not only do not get the defence investment plan, we don't ever seem to get movement. It's just everyone's very good at furrowing their brow. Al Khan's a good example of this. They all talk tough. They're all, come on, rugged as all hell. Oh, yeah, war with Russia, war with Russia. We never see any movement whatsoever. Dominic O'Connell's our business correspondent. You know this because you've been covering defence and defence infrastructure for forever. Has it always been that way? But maybe the threat is more real than it was. It's at least in the 2000s or the 2010s.
Well, there was a very big peace dividend, wasn't there, where government got very accustomed to not spending money on defence and finding other things to spend it on, and those other things are quite valuable for voters. So it is quite a tricky thing to do. Also, the other thing which has been a constant is this, has been the problems with defence procurement, typified most recently by the scandal of the Ajax programme. But that's been going on for as long as I've been doing defence, which is a very long time.
Are you surprised about this defence investment plan not appearing?
No, because they don't have any money.
So why, Trump in his State of Union address said, oh, the NATO countries have all committed, they're all going to deliver 5% of their GDP on military spending. That seems like completely untrue. I mean, we're going to be lucky to get to 3% or 3.5%.
Yes, exactly that. I mean, and the Defence Investment Plan, when it does come, and given that news we were talking about this morning, the idea that there may be a contract for Yeovil to build the new medium helicopter for the RAF, that's intimately bound up with the Defence Investment Plan. It's one of the elements in it. So if that's moving, then perhaps this Defence Investment Plan is only a couple of weeks away now.
Not irrelevant to a story that's just happened in the last few minutes, Rolls-Royce figures, because that's relative to aerospace and defence, isn't it?
Yeah, Rolls-Royce is a big defence supplier, builds the nuclear reactors for the Royal Navy submarines and engines for the Royal Air Force as well. But of course, its main business is aero engines for civilian aircraft. And Rolls-Royce has had an amazing comeback, a near-death. Well, it wasn't doing that well in the run-up to the pandemic. Then it had a near-death experience during the pandemic, when no one was flying, and it only gets paid when airlines fly. This morning it's reported profits of £3.5 billion in cash flow, which everyone was very keen on at Rolls-Royce, £3.3 billion, much better than expected, and very upbeat about the future. They're going to spend between £7 and £9 billion buying back shares over the next 3 years. And it's not often you can say it's down to one person. I'm sure we can't really in this case.
But I remember you introducing, is this the new chief exec?
We interviewed him when he arrived.
Yeah.
Tufan Ergun-Bilgic. He came from BP.
Yeah.
When he first arrived, he made this amazing speech in front of Rolls-Royce employees saying, listen, this company is a burning platform. You're all rubbish. We didn't say